Hi, my name is Mark McCullough. I'm the chair of the Department of Philosophy here at the University of Guelph. It's an honor to introduce Professor Christine Korsgaard of Harvard University, who agreed to visit us today to give a talk about the morality of our treatment of animals. Before telling you about Professor Korsgaard, I'd like to thank Professor Omid Peyro Shabani for all his work in setting up this event, and thank the staff in the philosophy department and the library and teaching support services for all their help in getting things arranged today. It's all gone very well. So, Christine Korsgaard. Christine Korsgaard is one of today's leading moral philosophers. She's known for defending a Kantian approach to moral questions. Following the ideas of Immanuel Kant. That's what Kantian means there. She's written many articles and books in which she stakes out many original views that lots of philosophers nowadays are discussing and responding to. When I say that Professor Korsgaard defends a Kantian approach, I don't mean that all she does is to explain what Kant said and then defend that against objections. Rather, she takes some of Kant's central ideas and elaborates them in original ways, also connecting them with ideas from other thinkers. In her most recent book, for example, she presents a unified view that surprisingly incorporates central claims from Kant and from Plato. What unifies these claims is a conception of agency. Agency is our ability not only to act for reasons, but also to step back from that and to appraise that relation, to ask whether this or that is a good reason to act. It requires reflection, not just action. What makes Professor Korsgaard's work interesting and important is that she pursues many interesting connections among a bunch of our concepts. Our concept of an agent, of a reason for an action, and our concept of action itself. In investigating these connections, Korsgaard shows how rich and fruitful those concepts are. They aren't as simple as they might seem at first, and they can be put to work in new ways. I hope it's not inappropriate to add a personal anecdote to this introduction. This is true. I was at a philosophy conference a few weeks ago and caught up with a friend from grad school whom I've known for 26 years, which that's a long time. We got onto the topic of how different it is being a professor from being a graduate student. When you're a student and you like philosophy, you're in graduate school, you're excited by almost everything you read. Now, as a professor, you've read lots of stuff, and it's just not as often that you get excited. I hope that doesn't sound like a depressing thing to say, but it's, you know, it's true. So I gave an example of something that excited me recently. I don't work in ethics, so maybe I'm easily excited on that topic. But my example was Professor Korsgaard's book, Self-Constitution, which I read last summer. It's a lively book with lots of neat ideas and arguments. And when I mentioned this, my friend said that the last thing that got him excited was a paper by Christine Korsgaard about Aristotle's concept of function. So the point of this anecdote is just that it's not that I'm old, it's that Christine Korsgaard does exciting stuff. So we're delighted and grateful that Professor Korsgaard agreed to come to Guelph today to give a public talk. I'm sure you'll find it interesting, and please do be ready with questions afterwards. We should have a microphone that we'll be able to pass around by the time question period starts. Philosophers always relish the question and answer period after a talk, so please feel free to jump in. Thanks for coming.
Can you hear me all right? Okay, I hope you have a copy of the handout. You'll find it makes it easier to follow along. I won't be referring directly to it, but I'll be making a number of distinctions, and you'll find them defined there. Now, some people use the term animal rights to refer to the moral claims of non-human animals, whatever those might be. In this paper, though, I'll be using the term rights in its more specific sense, to designate a certain kind of moral claim. A right is a moral claim that may be, and indeed ought to be, legally enforced. It's a matter of justice, not merely of humanity or kindness. Now, most people do think that animals have what philosophers call moral standing. That is, they agree that that animals are the appropriate objects of moral concern, and they think we have duties of beneficence or kindness to animals. Most people also think that at least some of these duties should be supported by legal sanctions. That's why there are animal welfare protection laws on the books. Yet, for reasons I'll mention in a moment, many people think it's absurd to suppose that animals have rights in the more specific sense I just mentioned. In this paper, I'm going to argue that animals do have rights, but rights with a different structure than that of most rights. Most rights are held against individuals, either against every individual in a group, as when civil rights are, or against some specific individuals, as when two people are bound by a contract or a promise. Animals, I will argue, have rights that are, at least in the first instance, rights against humanity collectively speaking, rights against humanity considered as a group. And these are rights to be treated in ways that are consistent with their good. I'm going to show that there are such rights, that is, rights against humanity collectively, by arguing that every human being who is in need of assistance in order to survive has rights with exactly this structure, rights against all of us taken collectively. Both that particular right and animal rights are traceable to the same fact, namely the fact that humanity, collectively speaking, is in a position to exercise extensive control over the fate of all of the inhabitants of the planet with whom we interact. Okay, so what's supposed to be the problem with the idea of animal rights? Well, I think there are three main objections to the idea. First of all, many people think of the realm of rights as being a realm of reciprocity. That is, rights are something we accord reciprocally to each other. And therefore, to say that you have a right implies that you also have obligations. It can be hard to pin this thought down in exactly the right way. For instance, one might be tempted to think of it as something like a bargain. I'll keep my hands off your property and your liberties if you'll keep your hands off mine. But making that kind of a bargain could simply be a matter of self-interest, and actually respecting the rights of others goes beyond that. Having rights, as we often tell the children when they claim them, implies having responsibilities and obligations. You can't have one without the other. But non-human animals, or so I shall suppose, are not moral beings and cannot have obligations. And so we might suppose, therefore, that they can't have rights. Now, a second and related problem is that some theorists, especially those working in the natural rights tradition, believe that the special point of rights, as opposed to other kinds of moral claims, is to secure the liberty and autonomy of those who hold the rights. Immanuel Kant, for example, thought of rights as coercively enforceable prescriptions that are essential to maintaining the equal liberty of everyone. The use of force or coercion against rational beings, he argued, is wrong, except when you're using force to protect someone's freedom, to hinder a hindrance to freedom, as he put it. So we can use force or coercion, that is, we can use the power of law in order to protect equal liberty, but not in order to promote other kinds of goods. John Rawls, to take another example, thought of rights in a liberal society as aimed at securing to each citizen, as far as possible, the ability to pursue her own conception of the good life, her own conception of what's worth doing and caring about in a human life. Rights ensure that we're not bound by restrictions grounded merely in other people's ideas about what's worth doing and caring for. We're only bound by restrictions that spring from the requirement of securing equal liberty for all. But of course, there's no point in trying to secure political liberty or autonomy in this sense to the other animals. They live according to their natures, not according to their values or their free choices or their conceptions of what's good. Nor is there much to be said for granting them the nearest analog to that kind of liberty, namely freedom of action in the simplest sense, allowing them to go where they please and do what they want. When animals, either wild or domestic, live within the confines of human society, it's essential both for their safety and ours that they live under a certain degree of human control. So on this showing, rights don't seem to be the sort of thing that we could intelligibly grant to animals. They protect the kind of liberty that the other animals don't have and couldn't possibly have. Most importantly, however, the idea of animal rights seems worrisome to people because of its practical implications. Are animals going to be recorded a basic right to life? And if so, are meat eating and hunting going to be outlawed? Would experiments on animals have to be brought to an end or limited to those that don't harm the animals? And what about those of our own activities that inevitably hurt or kill animals, even when the purpose of those activities is benign? We kill mice and rabbits when we drive tractors through the fields on which we grow our vegetables. We kill and injure birds when we put up wind turbines, or for that matter, windows and power lines. Whenever we use pesticides, we kill not only their targets, but other animals as well. Should all such activities be illegal or legally regulated in some way? Now, these are controversial questions, and I think that under any reasonable conception of animal rights, the answer to some of them is going to be yes. I'm claiming that the idea of animal rights can be made to seem reasonable. I'm not claiming that it can be made to seem uncontroversial. But the questions I've just raised lead naturally to some other questions that begin to make the idea of animal rights sound silly or unreasonable. If animals have a right to life, for instance, might people be prosecuted for killing vermin that are infecting their homes or their food supplies or swatting mosquitoes that are trying to bite them? And if animals have rights to life, or even just rights not to have suffering inflicted upon them, ought we to interfere between predators and their prey in the name of protecting the rights of prey animals to escape this kind of suffering and death? And must we then find adequate meat substitutes for the predators? Or should we actually try to eliminate, to phase out predator species altogether, as the philosopher Jeff McMahon suggested in a New York Times editorial a few years ago? Now, there are obvious reasons, based on past experience, to worry about human competence for tinkering with nature in this kind of scale. But even leaving those worries aside, many people find the idea of our managing nature in this way deeply distasteful, although the reasons are a little bit obscure. Some of us don't like the idea of living in a completely domesticated world. Some people feel that it's not part of humanity's business to try to moralize nature, or even that we don't have the right to. So these worries give rise to some rather deep questions about what the human place in nature is, and how we should think about and respond to the amoral character of nature itself. So for all of these reasons, many people, although they agree that we have duties of kindness and humanity to animals, think that the claims animals have on us don't arise from any rights on the part of the animals themselves. Now, before I examine that claim, I want to clarify the conception of rights that I'm working with here, which is a Kantian one. So far, what I've said has been ambiguous between two claims: the claim that animals should have rights and the claim that they do have rights. And there's a reason for this ambiguity, because there's a general puzzle about what's going on when someone makes the case for a legal right. If I said I was arguing that animals should have rights, that would have the disadvantage of making it sound as if all that I'm saying is that there's something to be said in favor of their having rights, some reasons that would support the policy of giving them rights. But that may not seem like the correct way to argue for a right, since a right ordinarily functions as a kind of trump, and a trump requires something stronger than some considerations in its favor. If I have a right to something, call it X, then you have no right to deprive me of X. My right is supposed to be a decisive consideration against your depriving me of X. However good your reasons for depriving me of X would be if I didn't have the right. And so to say that I have a right is not just to say that there's a very strong reason for me to have the thing to which I have the right. It's to say something about the relations in which I stand to those against whom I claim the right. However good others' reasons are for depriving me of X, they will be wronging me if they do so. And that includes my relations to society, collectively speaking. But if my right is a trump, even against society, collectively speaking, how could society, collectively speaking, be in a position to grant me the right? When someone claims she has a right, she's claiming in a way that no one is in a position to deny her that to which she has the right. But if no one's in a position to deny her that to which she has the right, then it seems as if no one's in a position to grant her that to which she has the right either. To get the feel of this, think about people who make claims like, say, in the United States, the Emancipation Proclamation gave the slaves their freedom. And ask yourself, was that ours to give? So what someone who says she has a right is saying is precisely that this isn't the sort of thing that anyone may either deny her or grant her, however good their reasons. But society can't give me the right if, in this sense, I already have it. Now, some philosophers propose to deal with the puzzle by invoking the idea of a moral right and saying that moral rights are the grounds on which we should establish legal rights. That enables them to split the difference. The moral rights already exist, although the legal ones don't. Then we can say that what society does when it enacts laws protecting people's rights is not granting them rights they didn't already have, but protecting moral rights by making them legal and therefore by making them coercively enforceable. And that can sound very sensible until we ask ourselves exactly what a right is. A right, at least according to Kant and many others in the natural rights tradition, is by definition a claim that may legitimately, that is morally, be coercively enforced. You have a right when you have a claim on others to act in a certain way, and it's morally legitimate for you or for society on your behalf to defend yourself with the use of force against violations of the claim. Not all moral claims, we believe, may be coercively enforced. I cannot sue you for hurting my feelings or being rude to me or have you thrown into prison for breaking my heart, although these are things you shouldn't do. I can't have you arrested if you fail to open a door for me when my arms are full of packages or to help me change a tire by the side of the road. How do we draw this distinction? Some philosophers would argue that the distinction should be drawn on pragmatic or consequentialist grounds, on whether the costs of coercive enforcement are worth preventing wrongs of this kind. Kant, however, believed that the distinction is based on principle, and we've already seen briefly what his principle is. We may coercively enforce a claim when we are hindering a hindrance to freedom. When the claim is something that protects someone's freedom. According to Kant, I'm free when I can pursue my own ends, and in doing so, I am not subject to the wills of other people. I'm not made subject to your will when you try to break my heart, because I'm perfectly free not to care. I'm not made subject to your will when you fail to open a door for me, because that doesn't stop me from going through the door. But I am made subject to your will if you enslave me or make use of my person or my property without my consent. So these are the kinds of claims that are coercively enforceable and therefore give rise to rights. Now, this account of what makes a moral claim coercively enforceable, what makes it one of right, makes trouble for the proposed use of the distinction between moral and legal rights. It follows from this account that if there are any rights, there's a sense in which they already have the status of law. That is, they may legitimately be coercively enforced. This, after all, is why we think it can sometimes be morally legitimate for people to fight even their own governments for their freedom, because they have a coercively enforceable right to that freedom, even if there's no law upholding it. On this view, natural right is supported by natural law. Indeed, they're almost the same thing. So the state can't be seen as making it possible to coercively enforce a claim that's already there, since the claim was not only already there, but already coercively enforceable too. Now, that might not seem like such a big problem, because, of course, there's still a question about the relation between law in this natural sense and the positive laws that are actually passed by some society. So why shouldn't we say that a state that makes a law establishing a right is simply acknowledging a natural moral right that's already there by making its own laws match the natural laws? But it turns out there's a problem with this claim, too, which was first brought out by the philosopher Thomas Hobbes and taken up by Kant. They pointed out that there's a sense in which rights don't exist even morally until positive laws upholding them are enacted by political society. After all, to say that a right exists morally is not only to imply that you're entitled to defend your claim with force, it's also to imply that other people have a moral obligation to respect your claim. But Kant and Hobbes argued that no one can be morally obligated to respect my claims, my rights, until he has some guarantee that I will respect his. If I force you to respect my rights without respecting yours or giving you a guarantee that I'll do so, then I'm putting you in a position where you're subject to my will, and so unfree. As Hobbes wrote, a person who respects the rights of others when they don't respect his would but make himself a prey to others and procure his own ruin. Hobbes and Kant argued that it follows that no one has a duty to respect anyone's rights until some mechanism of enforcing everyone's rights is in place. Since a right involves a duty on the part of others to uphold that right, and others cannot have that duty unless their rights are upheld as well, rights occupy what we might call interpersonal space. My rights and yours can only be realized together. Notice that this explains one of the intuitions about rights that I mentioned before, that there's something essentially reciprocal about them. Rights, according to this conception, are reciprocal in the sense that the existence of my rights depends on the existence of the rights of others. It follows that whenever you claim a right, you commit yourself to respecting the rights of others. Now, Kant argued that it's only the political state that can provide the needed guarantees of the enforcement of everyone's rights. So if I say, I have a right to X, I make a demand on others that I'm not in a position to make unless we live together in a political state. Claims of right presuppose the existence of the political state in the sense they presuppose our membership in some collective body devoted to upholding the rights of everyone. Claims of right presuppose this even if we are in the state of nature, the pre-political state, and the political state exists as yet only in idea. So when I claim a right in the state of nature, I commit myself to supporting the existence of a political state, that is, the existence of a collective devoted to upholding everyone's rights. Our rights in the state of nature are, as Kant put it, provisional. They exist in the sense that we have the right to defend them, but not in the sense that anyone else has a duty to respect them. It's only when the state is actually formed only when we get together, that they become, as Kant put it, conclusive. Now, I think that Kant's distinction between provisional and conclusive rights explains the status of so-called natural rights much better than the distinction between moral and legal rights does. Provisional rights are, in one sense, already legal, since the right holder is morally entitled to coercively enforce them. In another sense, however, they're not yet quite moral, since no one is yet obligated to respect them. What society does when it legalizes a right is neither to grant the right holder something that's already his own and not society's to give, nor to acknowledge a merely moral right that's already there by making it enforceable. What society does instead is to realize a right whose existence is essentially incomplete or imperfect in the state of nature. Okay, now, with that conception of rights in view, I want to ask, what exactly is the difference between saying that human beings owe a moral duty, saying that human beings owe a moral duty of kindness or humanity to the other animals, and saying that animals have a natural right, that is, a provisional legal right, in the sense I've just defined, to be treated in ways that are compatible with their good? Well, the tradition of moral philosophy supplies us with one fairly standard way of thinking about this kind of difference in terms of the distinction between perfect and imperfect duties. It's a distinction used by many moral philosophers since the 17th century. Now, as the distinction is normally understood, it goes something like this. A perfect duty is a duty to do some particular action. It is nowadays what's nowadays called a directed duty, meaning that it's owed to someone in particular, what John Stuart Mill called an assignable person. And that particular person is the one who is wronged when the duty is violated. A standard example of a perfect duty is the kind of obligation we incur through acts of our own, like making a promise. If I make you a promise, I owe you the act that I promised, and I wrong you if I fail to perform it. The duties of justice are generally considered perfect duties. Here, what's required is often omission rather than action. If you violate one of my rights, you've wronged me by performing that act which you should have omitted. We have an imperfect duty, on the other hand, when we're obligated to do some general kind of action, but the duty isn't specific about which actions we should do, and it's not owed to anyone in particular. Many people think of our duties of charity as taking roughly this form. We ought, we feel, to do something for those who are less well off than ourselves. But it's entirely up to us what form the giving takes and exactly to whom we will give. You can volunteer time if you don't have much money, and money if you don't have much time. You can give to Oxfam or the Red Cross, or you can microfinance would-be entrepreneurs in third world countries. Or you can give spare change to homeless people sleeping in doorways on the street. And all of that is entirely up to you. But no homeless person or would-be entrepreneur in a third world country has any particular claim on you. No such person is entitled to feel wronged or to drag you into court if you choose not to give to him. Imperfect duties, in short, don't correspond to any rights. Now, the picture that results is a familiar one, I think. There's a realm of justice in which we can make claims on one another. If those claims are not met, someone has been wronged. The duties of justice serve mainly to protect our rights and freedom. But a good person, a well-motivated person, will go beyond meeting the demands of justice. She will want to promote the good of others as well as to respect their rights, and so she'll engage in acts of charity, kindness, and beneficence. These actions cannot be required of us by law, but a good person will do them. It's into this category, according to the traditional story, that the morality of both kindness to animals and charities to strangers falls. And this is the picture that I wish to challenge. And I'm not alone. Nowadays, many people would call this story into question. An obvious worry concerns the duties of rescue. If you're driving down a deserted road and you encounter somebody who's been injured in a car accident, your duty to help him seems to be a duty of beneficence. You're concerned with promoting his good, not with protecting his freedom. But you don't seem to have the discretion that's supposed to be associated with imperfect duties of beneficence. You can't just choose either to help or not as you please in the way you supposedly can choose to give to a particular beggar on the street or not as you please. Of course, if stopping would put you in some sort of danger, or you are even now rushing someone else to the hospital, then we might think you do nothing wrong in not stopping to help. But short of that, it seems as if you owe it to the injured person to stop, and as if you will have wronged him if you just drive by. So there seems to be a required action and a specific person who will be wronged if you don't do it. And those are the characteristics of a perfect duty. Now, we might try to argue that the duties of rescue, unlike ordinary duties of charity, are simply our perfect duties. But Peter Singer has famously pointed out that our duties of charity to distant strangers often have all of the same features as the duties of rescue. That is, there are people in third world countries in conditions of famine or extreme poverty who are dying even as we speak. Assuming that there's simply not enough charity already on offer to meet all of the need, a small donation from you, not costly to you, could make the difference of life and death to one of these people. It's not clear which one, of course, so there's no particular person who can accuse you of wronging him if you don't make the donation. In that respect, the duty looks imperfect. But in other ways, it looks just like the more local case of rescue. Someone will die or be harmed if you don't act, and that seems to be a perfect duty. Now, this suggests that there's something wrong with the traditional distinction between perfect and imperfect duties. And to see this, just imagine a reasonably affluent society in which people are entirely well motivated. They're good, genuinely charitable people. If it were really true that it's an entirely a matter of personal discretion to whom each person gives, and exactly when and how, then someone could starve or die of an injury in their midst without anyone doing anything wrong, simply because no one happened to choose him as the object of their charity. Faced with this sort of problem, I think we should take a look at a different possible way of understanding the duties of beneficence. Not in terms of the idea that benefactors have an imperfect duty, but in terms of the idea that those in need have an imperfect right. The early modern philosophers who introduced this category into our moral thinking sometimes write as if an imperfect right was just the right correlative to an imperfect duty. But in fact, it matters which of these ideas we start with. Suppose we take the fundamental moral fact here to be that each of us individually has an imperfect duty to help others. It's not owed to anyone in particular. Is it owed to anyone at all? There seem to be two possible answers. First, it's really not owed to anyone, and it's an undirected duty. Or perhaps it's owed in some vague way to the needy. Apparently, then, it's the needy taken collectively who hold the correlative imperfect right, and the needy taken collectively who are wronged if it's not met. Either way, though, the analysis seems inadequate to the case. It's individuals, not just this group, who are wronged if their need is not met. But suppose instead that we take the fundamental moral fact to be that of an imperfect right. Then we can say that every person has a right to, say, adequate sustenance and care when sick or injured. But the right is imperfect because it's not clear who among us owes it to him or how exactly the need is to be met. Who then holds the correlative imperfect duty? The parallel answer is that it's all of us, members of the group taken collectively, who have a duty to ensure that each of us gets help when he's in need. I'll come back to the question which group exactly this is. Now, I am not the first to point out that assigning the duty of beneficence or charity collectively to a group explains some other intuitions that many of us have about this kind of duty. In particular, it explains the intuition that for each of us who does have enough to help others, there's something like a fair share of charitable contributions, a proportion of the total need that he or she should be expected to meet given her wealth and income. If others in the group don't give their fair share and you do, then not only those who remain in need, but you also are in a sense wronged by them because the duty of meeting the need is one you share with the group. It also implies that the duty of each of us is not, at least in the first instance, to give enough to charity to support all of the unmet need that we possibly could. Instead, speaking a bit roughly, the duty, our most immediate individual duty, is to try to organize the group in such a way that all of the unmet need will be met. This means that taking political action to realize better conditions where possible may be just as good or better than trying to solve the problem of unmet need through extensive charitable giving. The idea that each of us has an imperfect right to sustenance and care, should we come to need it, makes much better sense than the idea that each of us has an imperfect duty to offer such care to a few unspecified people. The idea that each of us has an imperfect right does imply that if individuals perish in our midst for want of sustenance and care, those individuals have been wronged. The imperfection of the right rests in the fact that it's hard to pick out any particular individual who's responsible for the wrong. But it seems perfectly in order to say that society or humanity taken collectively has failed to uphold the rights of this needy person and so has done wrong. Okay, so if we accept the idea of an imperfect right as a substitute for an imperfect duty, then we're left with some questions. First of all, obviously, is there such a right? Does each of us have a right to assistance when in need? And if so, why? And second, who exactly, what collective, what group owes the correlative duty? And finally, how can a collective have a duty? Now, I'm going to start by saying something about that third question. For an entity to have a duty, to be required to do something, that entity has to be an agent. On most accounts of morality, and certainly on Kant's, it has to be a rational agent, one who's capable of thinking and making decisions based on reasons. In particular, of course, the rational agent must be capable of recognizing that it has duties and acting accordingly. Okay, how can a collective or a group of people have a duty on this account? Well, like many philosophers, I think there's no problem in recognizing that groups of people can form collective agents in this way. Groups can think when their members can think, and when they can also talk and debate They can think together. And they can act, not just individually, but as a group, when they have a procedure for making decisions that makes those decisions count as the decisions of the group. Political states are collective agents in exactly this sense. A political state thinks through the thoughts of its legislators and makes its decisions by voting and passing laws. When it passes a law, that counts as an action of the state itself. So it's possible for a group to hold the duty that corresponds to an imperfect right, or any right. Now, of course, humanity, taken collectively, is not yet such an organized group. We have no procedure for making decisions that makes them count as the decisions of humanity as such. But Kant's argument shows us that a right can still exist provisionally against a group that as yet exists only in idea, so long as the idea is one to which those who claim such rights are committed. We saw before how rights are claimed against the political state even before the political state exists. And I'm saying all this, of course, because I believe that each of us does have a right to be helped to and in need, an imperfect right that we hold against humanity collectively. So I'll now explain why. Kant, as I mentioned earlier, thought that the function of rights is to protect the freedom of everyone. Among the rights he thought necessary for that is the right to claim things as our property. We can claim bits of the land and its products as our own. His argument for this comes in steps. First, imagine you're living in the state of nature and you pick an apple off a tree that no one owns. If someone attempted to prevent you from doing this, he would have to interfere with your body, grab you by the wrist, perhaps, and tear the apple from your hand. This would be inconsistent with your freedom. He would be using force to try to prevent you from acting, and you would therefore have the right to resist. It follows that you have a right to eat the apple, to make it your own by consuming it, simply because no one has the right to stop you. Now, that much only shows that we have a right to otherwise unowned things when they're in our physical possession. Kant thought it must also be possible for people to have a right to own objects even when they're not in our physical possession. If it weren't possible for us to own things even when they're not in our possession, we could not make free and effective use of any natural resource that we can't immediately consume or remain in physical contact with. The point is most obvious when we think about the use of the land, which Kant regards as the primary object of property. I can't grow beans on a piece of land if you are perfectly free to rip them out and plant wheat there instead whenever I'm not actually standing on the spot in dispute. So without property rights, we couldn't use natural resources without getting the permission of everyone who might possibly compete with us for their use. Kant thought this would be inconsistent with our freedom. Therefore, he thought we must all agree that it's possible for an individual to claim ownership in pieces of land, a kind of ownership that goes beyond physical possession. As we saw earlier, though, as long as we remain in the state of nature, these rights to the land are necessarily provisional. They can't be made conclusive until we're brought together into a political state in which we can make laws and establish the exact contours of these rights together. Kant took the argument to imply that those who live on adjacent territory have the duty to organize themselves into a state. It's people who live in proximity, who make claims of right against each other, and who therefore form the group against whom a right to property is held. But Kant was also keenly aware that ultimately all the territory on the planet is adjacent. The world is round, as he liked to emphasize. and human technology conquers the mountains and the deserts and the sea, breaking down the barriers between us. So ultimately, a claim of right is a claim against everyone else who can claim rights, a claim against every other human being. And that means that ultimately, whenever we claim a right, we presuppose the organization of the whole human race into an organized body that can uphold and protect the rights of everyone. And we commit ourselves to membership in that group. It's this conception of rights that gives rise to the duty to aid. In order to explain why, I'm going to return for a moment to the central question of the paper, the question of our relation to animals. I've explained why Kant thinks it must be possible for us to acquire rights in the land and its products, why he thinks we must be able to own property. Traditionally, philosophers have taken this kind of story also to show that we're able to claim the other animals as property. But why exactly should that be? Well, in the traditional doctrines of rights that were developed in the 17th and 18th centuries, and this now is especially true in the theory of John Locke, it's perfectly clear what makes it possible for people to claim property in the other animals. It's a view derived from Genesis to the effect that God gave the world and everything that's in it to humanity to hold in common. Each of us can claim parts of this commonly held possession for his or her own private use, provided he does so in a way that respects the fact that it's originally owned in common with others. Locke thought that when you took property from the commons, you had to leave enough and as good for others. Kant, as we've seen, thinks that when you claim rights to property, you commit yourself to upholding the parallel rights of others. Both of them insisted that the assumption that human beings hold the world in common plays an essential role in their explanation of why we can have rights to property at all. The role of the assumption in their theories, both of their theories, is to answer an obvious question. How could human agreements to divide the world up into objects of private property have any legitimacy if we had no right to the earth in the first place? Now, the idea that God gave humanity the world to hold in common captures something that goes right to the heart of the moral outlook, and that can certainly be formulated in secular terms. It's the idea that others have just as good a claim on the resources of the world as we do, and that it behooves us to limit our own claims with that in mind. More generally, it's the idea that others have just as much of a right to say what should happen in the world, what laws should govern it, as we do. Now, rather than grounding the idea of common ownership in revelation in Genesis, Kant characterizes it as an idea that we presuppose whenever we claim our rights. He describes it, quite surprisingly, as the right of every human being to be where he or she is. He says, "All human beings are originally in a possession of land that is in conformity with right. That is, they have a right to be wherever nature or chance has placed them. The possession by all human beings on the earth, which precedes any act of theirs that establishes private rights, is an original possession in common. The concept of this is not empirical. Original possession is rather a practically rational concept, which contains a priori the principle in accordance with which people can rightly use a place on the earth." Now, when Kant says that every human being has a right to be wherever nature or chance has placed them, he means that every human being is part of the group that possesses the world in common. No one is doing any wrong just by being here, so everyone has the right to be here. As such, every human being must be regarded as one of the group whose rights you must acknowledge when you claim your own. You claim to be part of this group simply because you're here, and so must accord that standing to others who are here as well. In fact, characterizing this most basic of all rights gives us a rather pleasingly literal way of interpreting the idea of moral standing. If you find yourself standing somewhere on the planet, then you're a being who can claim rights. Now, I know that the idea that we own the world in common may sound rather fanciful, but I think there's a way of putting it that brings out an important point. Obviously, the world is not literally owned by anyone, individually or in common, until human beings come along and set up our systems of property. So prior to any system of rights, there would be nothing wrong in my establishing myself on some piece of land and defending it against all comers. That is, I would not be violating anyone else's rights in doing so. But if I'm to think of my act as establishing that I have a right against all comers, then more than that is needed. Or to put the same point another way, if I am to conceive my relations with others in moral terms, in terms of right and wrong, rather than merely in terms of power, then more is needed. Because whenever I claim a right, as we've seen, I presuppose that humanity is an organized body dedicated to enforcing the rights of all the inhabitants of the earth. And if humanity did form such an organized body, then we would all have to agree through our legislative processes about who exactly has a right to what. And we could not all agree to a division of things that effectively denies someone the resources he needs in order to live. That would amount to kicking him off the planet, as if he had no right to be here. So my rights are, by their very nature, limited to a reasonable share of the world's resources. They're limited for the simple reason that others also have a right to the reasonable share. That means that if property is now divided up in such a way that some of us can only live because of the charity of others, then there must be injustice in the situation, even if no one has done anything wrong to bring the injustice about. As Kant himself wrote, one may take a share in the general injustice, even though nobody does any wrong by civil laws and practices. So if we now do a kindness to an unfortunate, we have not made a free gift to him, but repaid him what we were helping to take away through the general injustice. For if none might appropriate more of this world's goods than his neighbor, there would be no rich folk, but also no poor. Thus, even acts of kindness are acts of duty and indebtedness arising from the rights of others. Now, his point here is that if some people are rich enough to give, and some so poor that they need to be given to, that they can only survive if they're given to, then there must already be injustice, even if it's not the result of anyone's doing anything wrong. The world is not divided up into allotments of property in the way it would be if humanity were actually organized into a group and deciding on the division together. So we should regard our charity not as an act of free beneficence, but as the correction of a wrong. In other places, Kant draws our attention to the fact that this kind of inequality makes the poor need the charity of the rich. Now, plainly, if someone else is in a position to determine, say, whether you're able to eat or not through discretionary acts of his own, discretionary acts of charity, then you are subject to that person's will. And that means that by Kant's criterion, you're not free. So the traditional picture's distinction between a realm of justice concerned with the protection of freedom and a realm of beneficence concerned with the promotion of others' good does not hold up. Without rights to a fair share of the world's resources, the poor are a subject population. They are subject to the wills of the rich. Okay, so Following Kant, I've argued that the world's needy have an imperfect right to enough assistance to enable them to live. If they did not have that right, they would be wholly subject to the wills of the rich. Correlative to this right is a duty of humanity, collectively speaking, to provide the needed assistance. This right is imperfect in the sense that it's unclear who exactly should provide the assistance and how we're going to arrange it. Yet we have a duty to make this right perfect by organizing ourselves in such a way that the need will be met. We have this duty because such an organization is presupposed by our own claims of right. So here we have a right with a particular structure, an imperfect right held as against humanity, collectively speaking. That, I think, is the kind of right that the other animals have against us. In Genesis, God gives the world to humanity, explicitly including the other animals as part of the gift. On that showing, we have collective power over them, as we do over any other piece of property. But suppose that instead we conceive our relations to the other animals in moral terms, that we conceive them as fellow creatures, not just as objects that can be controlled and owned. As I mentioned at the beginning of this paper, most of us already do that to a limited extent, because most of us agree that we do have duties to the other animals. If we eliminate the category of imperfect duties, then we should think of the other animals, like ourselves, as having a right to be where they are, that is, as among the possessors of the world. After all, if humanity's claim to a common possession of the world is not grounded in revelation, then it's grounded simply in the fact that we're here and doing nothing wrong by being here. But that's true of the other animals as well. But of course, there's a difference. I've argued that when a human being claims a right to his share of the world and its resources, he presupposes the idea of humanity considered as a collective agent, making a fair distribution of those resources to everyone who has a right to them. This is why a duty to assist those in need is presupposed in every claim of right that we make. More generally, as joint possessors of the world, we claim a right to participate in making the laws that will determine what happens in the world, so far as that's up to human beings. But we can't form a collective agent that includes all of sentient life. Or if we did presuppose such an agent, it could only be an idea. The other animals can't join with us in setting up a set of rules to govern the world that we share with them. They can't join with us in shared deliberation about these matters or in making laws that inevitably affect their own lives and welfare. That indeed is why the other animals only have claims of right against us and not against each other. Humanity increasingly controls the planet, and other animals, or rather some of the other animals, are also increasingly subject to our will, that is, to our collective will. If we regard the other animals not merely as property, but as fellow creatures with a shared right to ownership of the world, then that subjection raises issues of justice, not merely of kindness. Animals, and here now I don't mean all of the insects and certainly not all of the tiny creatures that are everywhere around us, but middle-sized animals of the sort we interact with, the sort we all agree with are at stake in these discussions, animals are a subject population dominated by the collective power of the human species. And every individual animal as a member of that subject population is subjected to human laws. This is, of course, particularly obvious when we think about the animals in laboratories and factory farms who are entirely at the mercy of the combined power of human technology and organized human law. If human laws say that people can keep animals in tiny cages for the whole of their lives, fatten them until they can no longer stand on their legs, beat them when they put up resistance, and slaughter them in inhumane ways, then that's what's going to happen. If we regard ourselves as making laws not merely about the other animals because we have power over them, but but on their behalf, because we share the world with them, then they have a right that we should make laws that are consistent with the animal's good. The rich control the resources of the planet that we ought to share with the poor, so at least until we have greater justice, we owe them assistance as a matter of right. The more humanity becomes actually organized and therefore actually able to take collective action, the more outrageous it becomes that we don't organize in such a way as to meet this need. Humanity determines the fate of both individual human beings and individual animals through the laws we collectively make, determining what individuals may do to each other. Unlike the power imbalance between the rich and the poor, the power imbalance between human beings and the other animals is not something that will ever go away. But to the extent that animals live under the control of human laws, they are owed the protection of human laws. They have a right to that protection in the same way that the poor have a right to our aid. They have a right to that protection because they are a population effectively subjugated to humanity's collective control. Now, at the beginning of the paper, I mentioned some objections that people make to the idea of animal rights. And in conclusion, I'm just going to sketch the responses to these worries that follow from the account that I've laid out. People object that rights are a realm of reciprocity. I've argued that the kind of reciprocity inherent in the idea of a right is this. Rights can only be realized together. So when you claim a right, you commit yourself to the realization of the rights of others. This kind of reciprocity does not require that the animal should be capable of respecting our rights in order to have rights against us. The fact that the animals are not moral beings cuts the other way. It means we can have duties to them, even though they can't have duties to us. Second, people object that rights serve to protect a kind of liberty, the right to live in accordance with one's own values, say, that non-human animals could not possibly have. Now, it's true that animal rights of the sort I've envisioned are concerned with their good, not with protecting their liberty. But there nevertheless is an issue about freedom here, namely the freedom of animals from complete human domination, because like the poor, they're a subject population whose fate rests with our collective will. Third, people suppose that it's absurd to suppose that animals have rights because then they would have rights against each other. The rights that I've attempted to defend in this paper are rights that animals hold against humanity collectively, rights that arise from our collective control of their world. They're not rights that animals hold against each other, and I don't think my view implies that we should try to moralize nature. Sometimes we can leave it alone. Now, as far as the impact of acknowledging animal rights would have on human interests, more detailed arguments are obviously required. I'll note only that the argument that I've given applies to our relation to the other animals insofar as they live under our control. And they don't always do that. Beyond that, I can only say again what I said earlier. Yes, acknowledging the rights of animals would have an impact on our interests. My aim in this paper has been to show that the idea of animal rights can be made to seem reasonable, not that it can be made to seem uncontroversial. We may suppose that animals have rights against humanity for the same reason that the needy have claims to our aid. Because whenever we ourselves make claims, individual claims of right, a commitment to dealing fairly with our fellow inhabitants of the planet is implicit in those claims. Thank you.
So I'm going to take care of the questions, and then I'm going to hand these to Gerardo. Would you take it to the people who have questions? Thank you. So, first question. Yes, Brian. Wait for the microphone.
I heard you during part of the lecture talk a little bit about sort of the hierarchy of animals, but you didn't delve too much into it. I was just curious how this theory attempts to resolve sort of the problems with the hierarchy that, you know, I might be viewed poorly if I committed a bad act towards a puppy, but not towards a mosquito. I'm just curious sort of where your view comes into addressing the different levels.
Okay. Actually, the view does address the kind of case you mentioned, although not necessarily exactly on the basis of the so-called hierarchy. The point is that according to my argument, we owe it to the animals to legislate in accordance with their good insofar as we're in control over their lives. We are completely in control pretty much over the lives of a puppy. We are not completely in control over the mosquitoes. And in fact, we need to control the mosquitoes if they're, say, malarial for certain purposes. So they don't fall under the domination of our laws in the same sense that the puppy does. Now, of course, when we do have control, to the extent that we do have control, I mean, suppose we could get rid of a mosquito in a humane way versus an inhumane way, then we would have a duty to do that. But we don't in general have a duty to try to make sure that the welfare of mosquitoes, you know, is met. What we have a duty is to treat them in certain ways to the extent that we control them.
Yes, your name, please? Tracy Gold.
Isn't that kind of convenient for us that if something is small and we may not see it as a life as important as a puppy dog is to us. Mosquitoes are a pest to us for our crops. Isn't it convenient to say that we're not in control of their lives? Like, we are being in control of their lives by killing them. And I don't think there is a humane way to slaughter an animal or to kill an animal. It's still taking its life. If we're trying to give them rights or give them a protect their good, how can we still have these hierarchies? Like, shouldn't we be treating them all equally as all beings that are on this earth by your argument that we're all here and we all have our right to be here because we're all here?
Yeah, actually, the argument I get, as I said, it doesn't really depend on the hierarchy. It just, as it happens, the way things are now, it sort of matches up with the hierarchy. I mean, I would also think, you know, if you were being attacked by a thundering herd of some larger kind of animals, you would have a right of self-defense. A larger crowd of animals that you couldn't control and were having an impact of your fate, you would have a right to self-defense. It's just as it happens, we have long since already gotten control of most of the larger animals. So they fall under the argument, although things like mosquitoes don't necessarily do.
So in your view, there isn't a hierarchy of worth or of...
There's not a hierarchy of worth, to be sure. I do think there are cognitive and emotional differences among animals that could in detail affect what counts as treating them well or mistreating them. Not that there's a hierarchy that decides whether it's okay to mistreat them, but that there are differences that determine what counts as treating them well or mistreating them.
Yes, your name, please? State your name, please. Wait for the microphone.
So I'm curious about along these same kind of lines. So if I have a garden and I, by setting up this garden and taking care of it, I'm in control of the lives of the plants and animals that make up the ecosystem that's within that garden. Do the plants and animals and fungi and microbial ecosystems that make up the garden that I'm in control of directly all have rights against me on this account?
Well, first of all, I don't think the ecosystems do. because the argument I'm making only applies to sentient beings, and ecosystems are not sentient beings. Generally speaking, I do think that if there's a way in which you can affect these creatures well or badly, and now I'll bring in the answer I gave to the last question, because, of course, what counts as treating them well or badly depends on how cognitively and emotionally sophisticated they are, then you have a duty to treat them as well as possible, and they have a right that you should do so. One of the reasons why I think it's important that we regard these as rights against humanity, collectively speaking, is that there are cases in which it's very hard to settle the question how we should treat the animals under our control unless we settle it collectively. And your example gives rise to a small case, but never the real case of that. I mean, suppose you decide that you shouldn't be using a certain kind of weed killer in order to get your garden to grow well, and then your neighbors complain because their yards get full of weeds because you're not using the weed killer. That's a kind of case in which it's better if we decide together what kind of treatment is called for in these cases.
Okay, so if we're saying that our laws have to be consistent with the animals' good, but we keep them in our control, are we saying that keeping animals in our control is for their good?
No, I'm not saying that. I just think it's a matter of fact that they're in our control, given the technological level we've reached, and I take the increasing level of organization among human beings themselves, because as more and more there gets to be things like international law and treaties and agreements made about how we're going to treat whales or whatever, the more we're doing these things together, the more we exert collective control over them, as a matter of fact. And I don't think that's going to go away, but I do think it imposes an obligation of justice on us.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for a very interesting and thought-provoking talk. Two-parter. First, with rights, should we maybe simplify it a little bit and just say there are two types of rights, positive and negative? Positive entails duties of assistance. Negative entails duties of non-interference. And then we can kind of tease out the details from that kind of structure.
I suppose you could characterize things that way. I'm not sure exactly how that simplifies things.
Right. Well, to me, it's just if somebody has a right, a negative right to sit in that chair and to drink something from Starbucks or something, and he has a negative right, that means everybody else here owes him a duty of non-interference. We can't slap it out of his hand and that sort of thing. But when we say he has a positive right to have his coffee from Starbucks, meaning we all owe him a duty of assistance. We have to buy it for him. We have to hold the cup for him. We have to do all that. That would be absurd. But clearly, out in society, there are people that we would say we owe them duties of assistance, and therefore they have a positive right to do X. So.
Right. Well, I think it's important that the level at which I'm claiming that animals have these rights is the level of what laws we make. Because, of course, in your example of somebody with the cup and stuff, they have those rights because the laws have already determined
they
have them. And the duties of assistance, the reason those arise is not just because people need assistance, but with the thought that when we claim our rights, we're presupposing that we form a collective dedicated to the protection of everyone's rights, and that if such a collective existed, they wouldn't have divided things up in such a way that some people are totally subject to the will of others.
Right. And with the reciprocation of animals, then, that don't necessarily owe us duties, what about, you're at Harvard, so do you know Richard Wrangham's work at all with chimpanzees? He was a buddy of mine. So anyhow, wouldn't you say animals have proto-moral systems, and within those, like meerkats, chimps, bonobos, wolves, lions, they know the rules very well, and they know what the duties are, and they know what the punishments are if they act against those rules. So wouldn't you say humans at one point had proto-moral systems, and then we just became more conscious to put names on things and give words and develop things like philosophy and you know, figure out, you know, more complex moral systems?
No, actually, I don't think that. I think there's more of a jump at a certain point. Because although animals certainly have social systems and ways of enforcing those social systems, and those social systems involve their, in certain ways, joining together for the care of all, and in certain ways having order and discipline among them, all of that, nevertheless, there gets to be a difference when you become the kind of creature who can do something you're obligated to do because you're obligated to do it. Who can do something on the basis of moral concepts and moral thoughts. And I don't think that animals do that.
What about animals that have been raised in a lab setting so they've never experienced the natural world? Like, what kind of rights would you say they have, if any at all?
Well, I do think that we get into some very problematic issues about what counts as the good of an animal who has actually physically been modified the way some animals are now, or who has been modified by the way that it's been treated. And there are all kinds of examples of this where things get very hard for us precisely because we have brought it about that an animal almost doesn't in a straightforward way have a good. Simpler examples even than laboratory examples, many specially bred dogs have characteristics that are sort of bad for you to have if you're an animal. You know, they don't move right, they're subject to certain diseases and stuff. So it gets to be very hard to work out exactly what we're supposed to do for them once we try to serve their good. So I don't have any general solution to this problem. I do think it suggests that we should be very wary of messing with animals precisely in ways that makes it hard for them to straightforwardly have a good.
You mentioned that what separates animals from humans is that they don't have a duty to each other. And I just wanted to give the examples of wasps or bees. Don't they kind of have a duty like to the hive? They would protect the hive with their life if they had to.
What I said was not that they don't have a duty to each other, although I believe that, because I don't think you can have duties unless you can think about duties. But what I said is they don't do things for moral reasons or think in terms of moral concepts. They don't do things because they're obligated to do so. And I think that's required for you to have a duty, is that you have to be able to act on the duty, which means being able to think thoughts of that kind.
Hi. Do you think animals are capable of any form of rational thought or logical thought?
No, I don't. But when I say rational thought, I may not mean exactly what you mean by that. Because sometimes when people talk about rational thought, they simply mean the ability to take thought and solve certain problems, which lots of animals certainly have. By rational thought, what I mean is the ability to follow rational norms, recognizing them as norms. So to do things for reasons because you see them to be reasons, and because you see that you're under an obligation to do them for reasons. So I think in general, what I'm talking about when I talk about rationality is the ability to determine your own beliefs and actions in accordance with norms that you recognize as such. You don't have the mic. I can't hear you.
Wouldn't that system disappear without some form of structure or society?
No, I don't think it would. I think it's built into the form of self-consciousness that human beings have.
In a previous question, you mentioned the word sentience. I'm just wondering what you mean by that word when you use it.
What I mean by that word when I use it is that, first of all, that there's something it's like to be a sentient being, that there's a kind of subjectivity there, And also that what it's like is valenced, roughly speaking, that it's good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant, that its states are desirable or aversive to it.
That's the reason why I asked, because many forms of Indians, like the concept of conscience and consciousness comes out. And as we know, some animals do not exhibit or exemplify that from what we know about certain most animals. So I'm just wondering if your interpretation of that differs from what we commonly perceive as sentience.
Well, obviously, the question which animals have the kinds of states that I just mentioned, subjective states that are desirable or aversive, is an empirical question, one to be settled by empirical science. I'll only say about that that the serious study of animal minds is only 60 or 70 years old, and many of the things people have traditionally said about whether animals feel pain, what they're capable of in the way of subjective states and what they're not, have been things that people basically just said, just made up, and possibly to suit their own interests. So I think these are just questions that rate our attending to the hopefully continued serious study of what animals are actually like.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk. Very, very interesting. My question is about your claims that for duty to be duty, you have to think of it as duty. How do you address the regress that's sort of inherent in that claim? What gives the duty its force in the first place, I guess?
That's sort of too big a question for me to hand you an answer across the table, because actually what you're doing is asking me to give you a moral theory. And I could do that if I had the time, but I assure you, you would get tired before I did.
Thank you.
What happens in cases of conflicts between the good of human beings and the good of animals? Because obviously there's many, many such conflicts. So if you're talking about animals that are simply under the control of human beings, that would extend to animals that we eat, animals that we wear, and so forth. Is there an automatic ranking for you of human interest in those instances, or would it mean would legislating on behalf of the good of animals, or in a way that's consistent with their good, require us to divest ourselves of certain practices, such as using them for food and clothing?
Okay. Basically, I think we would have to. I mean, I think if we acknowledged animal rights, we would have to make very big changes, and they would be detrimental to our interests. I think that's just true. I don't think that's a reason not to do it. It never is in that kind of case. Generally speaking, I think it's important that we define the idea of a conflict between human and animal interests carefully. There's a conflict in a plain sense if for some reason or other you're faced with the choice of, say, killing an animal or letting a human being die. You know, I mean, the lion is charging the guy, and unless you shoot the lion, the guy will die. That's a conflict. I don't think there's a conflict every time we don't get to use an animal in ways that suit our interests. I don't think that counts as a conflict. It doesn't count as a conflict, just that we don't get to do whatever we want to with them.
Do you consider it killing an animal inflicting... Like, is that imposing on the good of the animal by killing it? Or do you consider only while it's sentient and alive and able to feel conflicting on its good?
I consider killing an animal to be bad for it because it deprives it of everything that's good for it. I know there are people who only think it's bad to make animals suffer, that they don't have any stake in their lives, so it doesn't matter if you kill them, but it does matter if you make them suffering, but I'm not in that camp. I think you're doing an animal a harm if you kill it.
So one thing I'm thinking of is that we're pretty bad at telling whether or not we're in control of something. So like with climate change, for example,
mm-hmm.
how, like, what kind of suggestions do you have for figuring out whether or not we control an animal's existence to such an extent that would warrant them having a right to a good?
I don't know that I have any general answer to that question that isn't perfectly banal in what anyone else would say. I mean, it really depends on thinking through the ways in which we affect them and what would happen if we didn't act in certain ways and what will happen if we do. But I don't know of any general answer to that question.
How close is this debate to legislating bodies across culturally? Like, we know we've already made a lot of progress with animal welfare with respect to the humane societies in the past century. And so other cultures, other nations, and how close is this debate within the legislative how much activism, as well as going on the different animal welfare groups, where's the state of what's the state of the debate right now? How close is animal welfare laws to? Are there any that are like controversially being presented these days, for example?
I think that, first of all, although there are animal welfare laws, and as I said in the talk, they're on the books because most people think some such laws should be there, they're very inept at protecting animals because every group that has an interest in harming animals manages to get either its own activities or the animals it deals with exempted from those laws. Animals in the research industry are not protected. Animals in the food industry are not protected. And even though there are now animal welfare societies and they do a lot of good, I think our relations with animals are the worst they have ever been and will get much, much worse in the near future because the quantity of meat that people eat has something like tripled or quadrupled in very recent times. I mean, people are eating meat not a few times a week, but three times a day. And as the growing human population in third world countries starts to take up eating more meat, as they are doing, there'll have to be more factory farms. And factory farms are the places where animals are harmed most, are treated most savagely by human beings. So I actually think we're on the verge of a real bloodbath. I think there's going to be, if humanity continues in the direction it's going in, there's going to be a lot of stuff going on behind the closed walls of those factory farms that will be supporting human existence in a way that most of us should deplore and be ashamed of.
Okay. It's 7 o'clock, and if anyone wants to continue the discussion, you're moving to Bouldering for the reception. So I invite you to join us. Please join me in thanking Professor Costa.
Thank you.